ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
There was a chook who was left something like £10 million in a will. She was called Jiju, but she was rich, so maybe posh, like Jiju. Anyway, does that mean I can leave my car to my cat or my daddo to my dog? What the Duck is presenting Nature's Most Wanted, the intersection of animals and the law. You know, pigs being tried for murder or ducks getting speeding tickets. What the Duck on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Annabelle Quince. In this Rear Vision, renewables and energy security in a changing world.
The ASX tumbling this morning with the global price of oil surging past $100 a barrel.
We've got eight prime movers, and the fuel, the diesel we use, has gone from about $1.75 in February to, as we drive around Canberra this morning, diesel is $3.15 up to $3.20. Currently, we are obtaining fuel, but I don't believe that's going to hold, which is why I'm really keen to electrify the fleet. Outside today are two electric vehicles, the Windrose and the Janus swappable battery truck. This is the future. It's a pity it's taken another crisis for us to act, but if we don't act this time, we're fools.
The conflict in the Middle East has led to a sharp rise in energy prices and highlighted Australia's energy vulnerability. But if you happen to be one of those lucky people with solar panels on your roof, battery storage, and an electric car in your garage, you're sitting pretty. But for the rest of us, it's high prices, the prospect of inflation, and if the conflict continues, fuel shortages. Australia's energy transition from an economy dependent on oil, gas and coal to one relying on wind, solar and storage has been complicated. For almost two decades, the debate around renewable energy was an environmental issue and not an energy security issue. But over the past few years, that has begun to change. So how have we ended up with the energy system we have today? How far along the energy transition are we? And just how reliable is the system we have? Tony Woods is a Senior Fellow for Energy and Climate Change at the Grattan Institute.
If you go back 200 years, most of our energy came from coal and oil, and we even made gas from coal. AGL, Australian Gas Light Company, that's what they were. They used gas for lighting. And so that's been the history. Electricity started to emerge about 110 years, something like that ago. In those days, the electricity was produced by burning something in a turbine. Oil or coal, it didn't matter all that much. And so most of the 20th century then we saw coal increasingly become the source of energy right through until the 2050s and 60s. The big change that occurred in the 2070s in around the world and in Australia was we realised that we could use this thing called natural gas, and that's a good marketing term because it's a fossil fuel, but we could use that rather than just getting rid of it because it was a nasty byproduct of trying to produce oil, because it existed in the same geological structures as oil, we could use that gas as a source of energy. And it was a very efficient form of energy. It was relatively clean. And so we started using gas more and more across the country in various ways. So we ended up with, as we got towards the end of the 20th century, the dominant source about electricity, particularly on the East Coast and to some extent Western Australia, is still coming from coal and the rest coming from gas. Renewables were less than 10%, with the exception of, that is, the hydro, the large Snowy Hydro project in the Snowy Mountains, which is both an irrigation and a power generator, and in Tasmania, sort of the same thing.
Prior to 1996 or the early 90s, all of our electricity was generated by these very large fossil fuel generators, predominantly coal-fired generators across the country. Professor Penelope Crosley, Professor of Energy Law at the University of Sydney. Prior to 1996, almost all of the power regulation was done by the states. And actually, if you even go back further to the constitutional conventions in the late 1890s, at that point, no power line had actually crossed over the state border. And so when the constitutional framers were trying to figure out who should have the power to regulate for the energy sector, they just thought, oh, well, that's fine. It can just go to the states. Now, unfortunately, what we now know is we have power lines that do cross state borders. And so we now have a system where we actually need to have the federal government and the state governments involved because of this constitutional framing, which is the source of many problems. But where that takes us to is prior to 1996, large, predominantly state-owned coal-fired generators powered through the network. We get to the early 90s and we get the Hilmer Review into competition law. He looks at it and says, actually, this is not efficient. It's not effective. We do have these interstate interconnectors and we actually need a better way of doing that. And that's when we got the national electricity market, which incidentally is also not national.
Yes, because there's actually two, one state and one territory left out. So that's the Northern Territory and Western Australia. And so do they have their own system?
They do. They do. So Western Australia has the WEM, the Western Australian Electricity Market, and the Northern Territory also has their own electricity market. And that's largely because it would have been too difficult to connect or too far to connect those two jurisdictions into the national electricity market, which operates down the east coast of Australia.
By the end of the 1990s, climate change was beginning to become an issue.
While scientists had recognised that this thing called the greenhouse gas effect was going to contribute to climate change, particularly if it was being added to progressively by burning fossil fuel, which is the heart of the Industrial Revolution. And so that was something that was becoming increasingly recognised. In the 1990s, the science started to become far more clear. The original science that was behind the Al Gore famous Inconvenient Truth documentary came out of that era, and increasingly it started to be taken seriously. Australia and other countries committed to the International Convention on Climate Change, and one of the things that came out of that was what's called the Kyoto Protocol, in which countries signed up to effectively a top-down commitment that we need to do something about this and try and keep the global concentration of greenhouse gases, in particular carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, to a number that was no more than it was back before the Industrial Revolution. Now, we never got back there. That was the ideal. And we all signed up to various forms of these commitments. Australia started to participate more actively in those international negotiations. John Howard was struggling with this issue. He was convinced by his own advisors that addressing climate change would be important. And a lot of work was done around that time in thinking about what's the best way to recognise in the way we consume things that are benefiting from producing emissions, what's the best way to suggest that maybe we have to change the way we produce those things, whether it's electricity or gas or fertilisers or explosives, whatever that might be. And the idea was, well, one of the best ways we're going to reduce emissions is to have more renewable energy. But at that time, the renewable energy, we're talking solar and wind, was at a very nascent industry. And so the question was, how can we really boost the renewable energy? So John Howard put in place a renewable energy target.
The renewable energy target introduced by John Howard in 2001 was modest. It aimed for Australia to produce 2% of its electricity from renewable sources. But John Howard also accepted the idea of putting a price on carbon, as did all the state governments and the opposition leader, Kevin Rudd.
The state governments in Australia started to think about this. They got the Roscano to do some serious work on how Australia should respond to climate change in a policy sense. Kevin Rudd got very enthusiastic about that concept. He and the state ministers at the time, most of the state were Labor governments, to think about, we need to put a price on environmental damage. And the state governments all together, with Kevin Rudd, as he was then opposition leader, developed the concept of a carbon price in Australia. This has been used in various ways around the world, particularly in Europe, in the early days of this thinking. A lot of businesses didn't like it at all. They saw it being an impost on cost of doing business. John Howard was convinced that it was serious enough, he better do something about it. So he also had his own bureaucrats develop a form of carbon pricing. When the 2000 election emerged, which is, some people might remember, Kevin 07, this is the election when Kevin Rudd did get elected and John Howard was defeated. both of them were talking about having a carbon price once they got into government. And John Howard never got the opportunity, and Kevin Rudd was the one who was ultimately elected. And one of his platforms was to introduce a carbon price. He immediately went to Bali and signed up to the Kyoto Protocol, which John Howard hadn't done. So it looked like everything was going to go in the right direction. All those Labor governments that said, oh, now that Kevin Rudd's elected, he'll do it all. We don't have to do anything now. As it turned out, how wrong they were.
The election of the Rudd Labor government in 2007 sparked the climate wars. First within the Liberal Party between Malcolm Turnbull, a supporter of renewables and combating climate change, and Tony Abbott, who supported coal mining and was sceptical of the science around climate change. Then between the Gillard Labor government and Tony Abbott over the so-called carbon tax, and after 2013, between the Labor opposition and a succession of Liberal governments, led first by Tony Abbott, then Scott Morrison, and finally Peter Dutton.
I think that the core of this was it turned out to be very successful politics for Tony Abbott as opposition leader. The mantra was axe the tax. And, you know, Julia Gillard got caught up in discussing whether or not the carbon pricing system she put in was actually a carbon tax, and she didn't do very well on that language debate. And as a result of that, it had to be supported by something. And so it was supported partly by saying, well, you know what? This is going to be too expensive. We can't afford to do this. And maybe this whole climate change stuff is mostly crap anyway. And so that's what happened. And so we've never recovered from that. And we've had people, moderates, absolutely, in the Liberal Party who are conservative in the classic sense. Malcolm Turnbull was an obvious one, who absolutely understood the technology and the science of climate change. This is not about religion. You don't have to believe in climate change. You have to accept the science of climate change. He saw that. And he was very supportive of carbon pricing very, very early on when he was Environment Minister under John Howard. But the power of the day inside the Liberal Party became stronger and stronger, and ultimately Malcolm Turnbull lost his job. The battlefield of climate wars is littered with the dead bodies of politicians, right?
Penelope Crosley argues that the roots of the climate wars are more complicated and go right back to the idea behind John Howard's Renewable Energy Electricity Act.
Well, this was one of the really interesting innovations of the Howard government, actually. In the year 2000, Australia passed the Renewable Energy Electricity Act. That piece of legislation is actually very unusual around the world. And the thing that makes the Renewable Energy Electricity Act unusual is that, unlike most other jurisdictions around the world, it makes it very clear from the legislative objective section that Australia was entering into the renewable energy sector purely for environmental and climate change reasons. And that is highly, highly unusual. We only see that in four other countries in the world. For most other countries in the world, they were concerned about renewable energy from an energy security perspective. They were seeking to diversify their supply away from fossil fuels. For us, it was actually a climate change play.
So most other countries, when they were looking in the early 2000s to actually diversify away from energy produced by fossil fuels, it wasn't because they cared, well, not that they didn't care about the environment, but they were actually worried about security, to secure enough energy to keep the lights on.
That's correct. And what you actually see is that they will invariably mention environmental protection or climate change in their legislative objectives, but it's often a number 5 or 6. And the first one is almost always energy security, diversify supply, and then also often industrial policy or kind of national economic development. So for most countries around the world, they didn't have the same levels of energy self-sufficiency and energy security that we have historically had in Australia. We have historically been blessed with a very large endowment of coal and also gas in a way that most other countries simply do not have. And so for us, entering into the renewable energy sector was always going to be an environmental and climate change play more than an energy security play, though that has changed in recent years.
So what impact did this energy war have on our energy transition between 2007 and 2020?
The energy sector in Australia became highly politicised. And I believe it became politicised because it was an environmental and climate change concern rather than an energy security concern. What we saw in countries where the predominant factor towards supporting renewable energy was around energy security is energy security is often quite closely linked in many jurisdictions to national security. There is a firm understanding that we need to keep the lights on. Everyone wants to be able to use their air conditioners or the heating. They need to cook food. They need to use their computers, whatever they might need to do. So in those jurisdictions, you tend to see much greater bipartisan support for renewable energy. And the climate benefits are often a side benefit. But that, again, has gone in waves, even internationally. Part of the challenge with all of this is it does go in waves. But I think in Australia, it was particularly politicised in a way that I would argue was unhelpful in terms of a successful transition. And I believe that a large part of the politicisation is because we didn't link our energy and our climate laws. So you actually had this renewable energy law, which was put in place for environmental and climate change reasons. We weren't historically concerned about energy security. You then get the South Australian blackout and everything kind of changes and people are suddenly very concerned about energy security.
This is Rear Vision. I'm Annabelle Quince and we're tracing the story of the growth of renewable energy in Australia and its impact on our energy security in a world that is becoming ever more insecure. Despite the energy wars and the reluctance of successive federal Liberal governments to support renewables, the sector continued to grow. And according to Andrew Blakers, Professor of Engineering at the Australian National University, that was due to a critical decision made in the 1990s.
There was one crucial decision taken back in the 1980s and 90s, and that was to turn the Australian electricity market into a tradable market where anybody who met technical specifications was allowed to connect their generator into the electricity grid. People who are developing this new market were thinking it'll be gas or coal or oil burning generators. Then along came wind and solar and started plugging in. And the Conservative government that we had for 10 years, with the notable exception of the Turnbull years, was generally anti-renewable, sometimes very strongly anti-renewable, and solar and wind just kept growing. Because from about 2015, it became apparent that solar and wind were cheaper than any alternative, much cheaper than new hydro, oil, coal, gas, nuclear, anything. And furthermore, were unconstrained for size, for scale. And to the chagrin of many people, and particularly the fossil fuel industry, solar and wind completely replaced all other forms of generation technology in construction of new power stations. So we built almost nothing except solar and wind for more than a decade now. All the growth, all of the replacement of retiring power stations has been solar and wind. And the politics hasn't been very important. It's a market-driven thing. It's simply cheaper.
The other critical factor was the role of state governments, of all political persuasions, who all supported the growth of renewables.
One of the really exciting things actually in Australia is that because we do allow the states the constitutional power to regulate energy, is that we actually saw some really interesting innovation at a state level. And there seemed to be a general opinion amongst many states that actually the energy wars were unhelpful at a federal level and that they would need to go it alone. And so we started to see the states derogating away from the national electricity rules. We started to see states innovating, and you see South Australia bringing in the big batteries. You start to see the advent of things like renewable energy zones. You started to see states bring in their own subsidy schemes for things like rooftop solar, which you couldn't do at a national level. And so you start to see the states actually beginning to actively compete to try and actually do the transition.
Two or three things happened all at once. One was the government's introduced quite strong supporting mechanisms for rooftop solar, a domestic version of the renewable energy target that John Howard had introduced. In addition to that, they started paying people for selling their renewable electricity back into the grid when they had too much, like in the middle of the day. And thirdly, thank you to the Chinese, they dramatically drove down the cost of solar, like from 80%. No one saw that coming. there was a period of time where you would have got a payback on your rooftop solar system within 6 months. It was staggering how generous those schemes were. And of course, the government's started to walk back from some of those schemes because they were almost too generous. But the consequences were we've now got to the point where 30 or 40% of homes now have rooftop solar. It has its own challenges to manage all that electricity coming off the roofs of business of houses in the middle of the day in summer, for example. But it has contributed dramatically to the increase in renewables. And it's one of the reasons why we see those high percentages I was talking about.
The state that led the way both in supporting renewables and decommissioning old coal-fired power stations was South Australia. But in 2016, things went badly wrong.
It's been a long night for South Australians after a blackout yesterday afternoon plunged the entire state into darkness.
Driving through the darkened streets of Adelaide, there was an eerie silence broken intermittently by the sound of alarms. South Australia went off the grid around 4 o'clock yesterday afternoon following severe weather, which downed transmission lines and more than 22 towers at 5 points across the network. The Premier, Jay Weatherill, says no system could have coped with an event of this kind.
We had a statewide blackout in South Australia in 2016, and it was so complicated. If you believed it was caused by renewables, you could easily find facts to support your position. And if you believed it wasn't caused by renewables, you could find facts to support your position. And so you ended up, again, a battle around what's going on here. So that was one event. And then we also have had several events where the aging coal, we need to close down the aging coal-fired power stations, but not before the renewables are ready. And so we started to run into the challenges of getting all the renewables built because they were becoming more expensive. We had community pushback in terms of didn't like them very much. And we had regulatory processes that started to take too long so that the whole thing was going too slowly. So we weren't ready to close down the coal. And so we started to think about what do we do about that. And when the first of the big coal-fired power stations closed down in Hazelwood in Victoria in 2017, we weren't quite ready for it. When AGL threatened to shut the Liddell power station because it was too old and broken, the federal government, Malcolm Turnbull again, got really upset because he was supporting renewables, but he didn't want to see the lights go out. Because remember, if you want to really push the objections to renewable energy and the transition, one way to do it is to have the lights go out. You lose confidence very quickly. Remember, the three things are affordability, reliability, and sustainability. And to some extent, reliability on average will trump all three.
When Prime Minister Scott Morrison announced his new energy policy late last year, he introduced a type of energy generation few experts had ever heard of, fair dinkum power.
New fair dinkum power generation. What do I mean by fair dinkum? Stuff that works when the sun isn't shining and the wind isn't blowing. That's the reliable power that we need in our system.
But this suggestion that wind and solar create unreliability in the electricity system is being challenged by the Grattan Institute.
And the linking of blackouts to renewables is really not accurate. 97% of power outages occur in the poles and wires that transport power from the power stations to homes and businesses, and less than 3% occur due to faults in generation or in the large-scale grid that's affected by the source of power.
He identifies a statewide blackout of South Australia in 2016 as the beginning of what the report calls a false narrative about the unreliability of renewable energy.
Well, I think there's a lot of foolish people who say after the grid collapse in South Australia 10 years ago, oh, look, this is a problem with renewables. It's only a problem if the next sentence isn't, and we're going to find solutions. And it turned out solutions are really straightforward. You have solar and wind spread from Cape York to Adelaide and everywhere in between, and that hugely smooths out local weather and demand. You strongly interconnect the states so that if South Australia is covered in cloud and no wind, you can borrow from Victoria or New South Wales or Queensland and return the favour next week. You add in storage, and that means pumped hydro energy storage and batteries. So batteries are going in at breakneck speed, both utility batteries and home batteries, and are flattening the high prices that were used to be experienced in the evenings when the sun has gone down and gas and coal make a lot of money over 4 or 5 hours of that evening peak when the price goes high. Well, batteries are eating that fossil fuel revenue. They are just eating it. Now the issue for storage is nighttime and a wet and windless day or week. And again, this is pumped hydro and batteries. So Snowy 2.0, which will be completed in about 3 years' time, will be about 80% of all the storage in the national electricity market from 2029 onwards. And it can run flat out for an entire week. This is the role of gas at present. Snowy 2.0 is going to badly damage the revenue of gas, and I'm not very sorry at all about that.
That question of storage is a really important one, which has not yet got enough attention, as is that unusual role of gas. People talked about gas as being a transition fuel. Oh, it's lower emissions than coal, so why don't we use gas for a while and then go to renewable? Well, that was when gas was cheap and solar was expensive. That's all turned around now. And I think the other one is we've still, while we talk so much about renewable electricity, we don't talk enough about the emissions from other sectors of the economy, because this is a transition that affects every single part of our lives somehow or other. Whoever you are, whatever you do, wherever you live, whatever your occupation is, climate change or the consequences of dealing with climate change is going to affect you. We have to have our political leaders creating and delivering the narrative around what this is really like, what this is really going to mean, what it's going to mean for costs, what it's going to mean for prices, what it's going to mean for impact on rural communities and so forth. Providing that narrative is what's sorely missing. And unfortunately, because it has been such an abrasive climate war, the capacity for our leaders to go out and explain to the community what this means has been reduced. The things that got us into trouble, and we've talked about this already, Annabelle, was the time when Tony Abbott realised what a powerful weapon being anti-climate change was going to be for him, and he became Prime Minister. That was a sad story, but it created the worst of the climate wars, which hasn't gone away yet. I don't think it's going to go away anytime soon. So in the meantime, I look to our current government federally and those state governments where they need to tell the same story themselves, and we have some chance then.
So today, in 2026, how much of our electricity comes from renewables and storage?
Well, across Australia, the last quarter of last year, it hit more than 50%. That's the first time that has happened. It varies dramatically across the states, and that reflects history and geography and geology as much as it does political intent. It's about 45% average across the year, but we've hit 50% now on a quarterly basis, and it's increasing all the time.
New South Wales Premier Chris Minns is reassuring motorists there's no need to panic buy petrol and diesel as the war in the Middle East continues.
Back home, the federal crossbench have joined forces to call on the government to take more steps to bolster Australia's economic and energy. Independent MP Monique Ryan says Australians are...
We can make changes to settings around gas and oil markets, which would benefit the country economically, but also ensure that we have sufficient gas domestically. And there are things we can move on to help households electrify and make their homes more energy efficient.
Renewable energy, specifically solar and wind, gives you resilience at every level from the household right up to the country. If you have all electric home with solar panel on the roof, a home battery, electric vehicle, electric storage, hot water. If the grid goes down, you can last indefinitely with almost no change to your lifestyle. If you're in the middle of winter, you might have a cold shower every now and then, but everything else will be powered from your solar panels. The same principle applies at the city level, the state level, and the national level. If the oil is cut off and you're relying on oil-powered cars, you've got about 2 or 3 weeks to work out a solution. It's simply more resilient and reliable.
Andrew Blakers, Professor of Engineering at the Australian National University. My other guests, Tony Wood, Senior Fellow for Energy and Climate Change at the Grattan Institute, and Penelope Crosley, Professor of Energy Law at the University of Sydney. I'm Annabelle Quince, and this is Rear Vision. Thanks for joining me.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.